Good morning, Blair. Great to see you. I guess you beat the traffic, and boy, are you punctual. You're right on time. I appreciate that. I'm sorry that your partner in crime had a flight issue, so it was rescheduled or delayed, and she couldn't make it, but she will be back, because I know she was really excited about coming on at some point soon. So good to see you, Blair. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself there, buddy?
Good to see you as well, Jason. Yeah, sorry about she couldn't make it. She did have a flight issue. For your audience, my name is Blair Ector. I'm a lawyer here in Calgary at Loberg Ector LLP. And yeah, happy to be on the show here today. Mr. Levine, Mr. Best, good to see you guys. Last time I seen you guys would have been in Ottawa when you were bringing us coffee and so on and so forth.
That's right. You recruited us to be your coffee people. We would get the containers of coffee. You're not wrong, but we needed to keep you fueled, and because we needed you there, Blair. Yes, we met you in Ottawa, the Helen Grew stuff. We won't go into detail because it's an active case, and we'll respect all of that. But yeah, that's where I got to meet you for the first time. And Blair, look, I'm not kissing butt. You're already here. I'm really impressed with your presence during the hearing. You're quick. Wit, because you actually have a lot of wit that came out as well. Sashimi Shakedown is one of my favorite quotes. And the way that you guys have this excellent dynamic between the two of you when you're working a matter behind the scenes and during the hearing, I noticed that there was quite a nice dynamic there. So thank you very much for allowing me to get you on the show. And again, sorry for Bathsheba not being able to make it. But I'm not kissing your butt. You're already here. But I think you've done an excellent job representing Albertan lawyers over in Ontario, and this might be the way we kick some butt. But thank you for joining us today. Can you maybe let people know about your law firm and what do you specialize in, if anything?
Sure. So, yeah, so Loberg Ector LLP, we are a law firm here in Calgary. We practice mostly these days commercial litigation. We do some administrative law as well, lots of civil litigation. But early on in my career, I did a lot of criminal defense work, lots of criminal defense work. When I was a young lawyer, kind of cutting my teeth, and then as a solo practitioner, lots of drug trafficking, organized crime type of work. Predominantly right now, I do a lot of corporate white collar crime on plaintiff side. So going after the bad guys that are taking fraudulently taking money, which I like. Justice referred to it as crossing the Rubicon, putting myself right in that regard. So I really like doing a lot of the shareholder disputes. I still do some administrative law. We represent, obviously, police officers. We do judicial reviews of administrative decisions, which we just filed one for the CCFR this week to the Federal Court of Appeal with respect to some gun legislation. So yeah, pretty well-rounded barrister litigator. I'm a litigator through and through. The thought of doing real estate contracts and with all due respect to my solicitor friends, the non-trial courtroom lawyers, is just not something I can imagine myself doing. So I'm a trial lawyer, basically.
Awesome. And I thought about throwing in an objection or two in there while you were talking just to throw you off because I know it doesn't work. You keep going. So Donald, you've been watching Blair for a while through the Groove stuff, but you've been watching him for a while. What was your first impressions of him and what do you think of him so far? Oh, you're muted. You found a way to mute yourself. Oh, my.
Yeah. Okay.
It's Friday.
It's Friday. It's Monday. Maybe it's Wednesday. I always do. But, Mr. Ector there, without going into where I've seen him and what venues, some of the cases he deals with are tribunals that are very difficult because it seems the rules are a little looser than regular court. And this is, I think, an additional challenge. And without referring to any specific case, I would love to hear a little bit more because many of the people we're dealing with the whole vaccine scene and everything, it's internal tribunals. It's their employer, of course, or medical people and such. And what I saw with Mr. Ector and his partner, Bathsheba Vandenberg, was you obviously have great knowledge about these tribunals, but also you just are able to work together, and it's this dynamic that I think that Jason was talking about where you know where you're going as a team. and one sets it up, but the other one takes the shot or something like that. And it was just great to see you guys work together because, well, frankly, you're just top drawer. It's just wonderful to see really competent people who are really into, what's the word here? You believe in your clients. It seems like you don't. I've seen you at a couple of different venues, and it looks to me like you don't take cases unless you really believe in them.
Oh, that's the case?
That's an important thing, I think.
And Blair, can we just get you forward a little? Your audio is a little bit low. Yeah. Just so do you take cases where you believe in your client? Do you vet your clients?
Yeah, of course we take cases where we believe in our client, but I think more so. I mean, I think that's the duty of the lawyer to zealously advocate for their client's interest. And, you know, when you see Ms. Vandenberg and myself doing that, like, we do work hard at what we do. That's not by accident. We don't just show up and randomly just start asking people questions or randomly just start making submissions. We put a lot of time and effort into planning that, into developing legal strategy. And it is a massive commitment to your client's cases, to our client's cases. And we adopt the policy here is excellence is the only standard. That is the motto of my law firm. Excellence is the only standard. That is what we bring. That is the only thing that we will tolerate here. And then we hold ourselves accountable to that and commitment to our clients. That goes a long ways, being very committed. And Ms. Vandenberg and I have worked together pretty closely. We first had done some of the Emergencies Act case. We had some clients who had bank accounts frozen, some military members and police officers who had bank accounts frozen was how we kind of began working together. And then she ended up joining my law firm as well. And we do have a pretty good dynamic. We do have a good team. I definitely certainly enjoy working with her. I think it's mutual. We really are dedicated to our clients, and I hope it does show. I mean, I don't want to talk about the case or anything like that that you guys got to witness, and I'm not going to discuss active cases, but, you know, when we're on trial, we're working, like, you know, 16, 18, 20-hour days, right? Like, we are nonstop working. Like, that is not just a random show up, ask a few questions, don't know where I'm going. Like, we're pinpointing, citing evidence, having quadratics on the board, developing strategy for months in advance. Like, a good cross-examination takes months and months of work. Setting things up, moving things, and that's why, you know, it's important to get in the rhythm on a cross-examination. One of the things that is great is to help out from a lawyer's perspective, but when you're doing cross-examinations, one of the things you really want to do is establish control with the witness and who you're examining, is that you put them in different boxes and ask different questions where it shows that you have knowledge for every single question you're asking. You have something to back up if they don't agree with you. You can show a document you can put in their face or something that you can refute or rebut. And after doing that for a while, eventually the witness understands what they're dealing with in terms of the level of preparation, and you get those agreements and those admissions that you need down the road later on during an examination. But that all takes a tremendous amount of work and preparation. And to answer your question, yeah, we do take cases we believe in our clients' causes. You have to. You have to as a lawyer. And you don't have to the extent where I think really good lawyers have a quality, you don't have to necessarily believe hold every single personal belief that your client hold. I mean, we are free, autonomous thinking people, but you have to believe in what you're advocating for. You have to, that I think if you don't believe what you're advocating for, it shows. I always have a saying too, people can sense sincerity. People know when people are being sincere, right? This isn't just a job for us. This isn't just a paycheck. This is a career, a life, you know, and excellence is the only standard. And that's the only thing that I will ever tolerate in my law firm and in my personal life. And the culture that I want to establish here. And, you know, cultures are established. You can't see it right now, but the courthouse is over my other shoulder in Calgary. And I always tell my associates when they come in or you know, I'm working with, it's like reputations are built over there. It's not on social media. I don't even have Facebook. I have a LinkedIn picture that's like 5 years old. I'm a very active, as I've kind of told you before, I like to more operate in the shadows, I like to more be about my work and about my clients, not about myself. But certainly applies, I think, believing your clients' causes. Of course, it always applies. And yes, we do get to pick and choose the cases we take, certainly.
So one of the things we were talking about before you came on was there's good lawyers like you behind the scenes in the shadows, like you said right there. You don't even have a Facebook page. That's a double-edged sword, though. Like, it allows you to do your work and do what you're doing, but the public doesn't know who you are. And, you know, sometimes where they're looking for a good lawyer, they end up in the yellow pages. They're asking their neighbor, or they're asking their grandmother, do you know somebody? So what we're talking about before you came on was maybe trying to showcase lawyers in the freedom movement or in Canada that are doing good work so that people know about you. It's not for you to really go out there and market yourself, because you're already doing a good job. I'm sure your word to mouth is doing good. But what do you think about trying to find good lawyers, bring them forward in the public space, and have conversations with them like we're doing right now? Is this something that the profession would be open to? Because we really need to celebrate, I think that's the right word, celebrate the hard workers that are in the shadows working hard for us in the freedom movement.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be a case-by-case basis for who wants to get involved with that. I think it's a good idea to showcase, you know, people that are working hard behind the scenes. You know, and so some people do want the spotlight and do want it to be all about them. My view is always client-driven, client-centric. And that's, I think, led to a decent degree of success is to really be client-focused. But, I mean, in terms of spotlighting lawyers who are doing excellent work, yeah, I think that it should there should be credit given to people that are doing work. And one of the things, you know, there's a quote from Shakespeare that often gets misquoted from Henry VI. It's first thing we do is kill all the lawyers. That's the first. And that quote is often very misquoted as saying on a detrimental side of a lawyer. But it's actually the context that it's in is that people are trying to perform basically a coup and an overthrow of the current king and the government. And they're saying the first thing we can do is we got to kill all the lawyers. We got to get rid of the lawyers because those are the people that hold up our society and hold up our system. And those are the people that when you look anywhere where there's, you know, a lot of civil strife, the first people that are attacked typically are getting rid of lawyers, the people that can stand in the way against tyranny. So that's often a misquoted thing. So to draw attention to people that are putting in a lot of the work behind the scenes and, you know, putting in the tremendous hours that the public doesn't get to see, I definitely think that'd be a good thing too, in terms of how much attention those people want on them. I think that's a case by case basis.
Yeah. No, for sure. And what I also wanted to highlight with that is we need to know who the good ones are. And we also need to kind of hold lawyers accountable. So kind of have a platform where they know that they're being watched, viewed, or judged, or they can lose that credibility if they do anything wrong. Because I want to fight against this misnomer that lawyers will just take the money and run because one or two have done that in the past, and we keep hearing those stories. Because that causes, I think, a distrust that doesn't need to exist anymore. I know that there's a lot of jokes about lawyers at the bottom of the sea is a good start and all those kind of things. I get it. And also put that in the same category as used car salesman. Like, it's really not a fair stereotype. So I kind of want to fight against that because we need this kind of representation. Now, what you said there, Blair, was it triggered me quite well because they're supposed to be the one is one of the last guards for us when it comes to tyranny. But COVID, it seems like there was like a massive drop of the ball with a good chunk, not all, but a good chunk of lawyers where they didn't want to take these cases on. I don't want to highlight Gruce at all, but you're an Alberta lawyer working an Ontario matter, and it could be because she couldn't find decent representation local. Did you notice in the last few years that your colleagues, I don't want to say are spineless because that's not a fair assessment, but they're putting their career and maybe their business ahead of justice at this stage when it comes to at least the COVID side of things and the freedom side of things?
That's tough to say. I can't speak to anyone else's frame of mind or their circumstances, what they're doing.
In general.
That's tough to say. I think there's a lot of lawyers here that are in Calgary and Alberta in particular that have fought and stood up. And you know, maybe I'm living in my own world and focus kind of on what I'm doing and what I can do to advance causes. I'm kind of, I adopt stoicism as a principle of my life. So I worry about what I can control and what's in my control. And I don't really tend to worry about what's not in my control in terms of are other people afraid to rock the boat and take on cases that maybe someone at a dinner party is going to question you on. I don't know. Maybe there are. That's not how I adopt and live my life. I don't take decide cases on, oh, what's that person at the dinner party going to say about the cases I take on. That doesn't really affect me too much. Like, again, early on in my career, I did a lot of organized crime, drug trafficking work. I'd routinely get stuff. How do you represent those types of people? And then when you explain the charter, well, okay, police don't have a right to just kick someone's door in and just go and take their stuff, right? Challenging ITO, challenging warrants. Those things are very important to hold the people in power accountable. And that's something that, again, maybe that's just, I'm living in my own world. I've got a young family. I coach hockey. I play hockey. I got my law practice. I got a busy life. I don't really concern myself too much with what other people are doing. But to address one of the points you made earlier about lawyers just taking money and going, that's not what I see. That's certainly not what I see.
That's rare.
That's not the lawyers I associate with. That's not really, that doesn't jive with my experience. whatsoever. I do hold this profession in very high regard. I have a lot of respect for my colleagues and this profession, and because it's something that I dedicate my life to. And so, again, I don't think that that is even remotely in a sizable minority of cases where people are just taking money and doing nothing. I don't think that that jives. I think that, sure, that may happen. There could be bad doctors. There could be bad mechanics everywhere. I think, by and large, I have a lot of respect for my colleagues, what they do, even the ones I disagree with and I'm on the other side against. I do respect our system. I do respect what I do, and I have a lot of belief in the integrity of the people that I associate with and the people in my profession, and I will defend my profession and something I dedicate my life to.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I want to go with this, is I want to get rid of that misnomer, because we hear this even with fundraisers, you know, don't give it to the lawyers, give it to me, I'll take care of it for you. Lawyers can't be trusted, they'll run with the money. We all know that. No, we don't. I don't agree with those statements at all. And I actually think that the system in Alberta is not bad at all. Actually, I think across Canada, overall, it's not bad. People get upset when the judgment doesn't go their way, and they start throwing around these terms like, oh, that judge is bought off. But I don't believe that at all. I've been watching enough of this to know that some of these decisions are really, really hard. Now, Donald, I'm going to run to you quick, and then we'll go back to Blair. Do you want to share with Blair some of your experiences with your lawyers, and how one of them that you were just talking about before the show really, really believed in you, and you felt that that was important as a client to have your lawyer believe in you? Not necessarily believe every single thing you say, but believe in you, that your mission is good, and that whatever brought you into court needs to be addressed?
Well, mine was a special case, Mr. Ector. I had a situation where, unfortunately, some lawyers have been caught fabricating evidence against me, and there was a general malaise in the profession to address that, to the point where I was going down, and I eventually did go down and spent 63 days in solitary confinement. I was later vindicated, but I was later vindicated because of one lawyer who came in and saw me in prison and decided that he wanted to bring me justice. And that's about how I'll look at it. So he believed in my case, and eventually I was vindicated. Even the former commissioner of the Ontario Provincial Police did an investigation, swore an affidavit that one of his men had taken a bribe from the lawyers. The lawyers had fabricated evidence that he testified to all that. So I'm vindicated. That's great. But my journey finding a lawyer for this very important case was really something, because I went by reputation, and I think I should have just sat down and spoken with people for a half an hour before I hired them or done something more. So my question to you is, how does an ordinary person who's never been involved, they're in big trouble for the first time in their life, how do you go about choosing a lawyer who will be both competent but believe in you? How do you do that?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first thing is you should speak to more than one lawyer, you know, when you're deciding to hire someone. And then, you know, look to your network of friends. Like, I would say that almost all of my files are referral-based from other lawyers, from friends, from previous clients. Work that network. And then, sit down and talk to people. Talk to your lawyer. Talk to what their strategies are, how they deal with things. And one of the things, too, is, like, you should have a lawyer that shouldn't just blindly accept what you say to them, too. Like, I push my opinion on things. I begin cross-examining them right from the first intake interview. Like, and to say it's not to disrespect you. I'm going to stress test your case. I'm going to see how this holds up. And get someone that's very, you know, aware, listening, paying attention to you, listening to what you have to say, trying to understand where you're coming from. And in particular, when you're facing something of a criminal charge in nature, it's like often you have nowhere to turn to. Often you have absolutely nobody to turn to. And that is all the more important with doing it. It's one of the things I miss when I'm doing a lot of criminal defense work. I still do some work, not as much anymore. But it's that, you know, that bond you have with a client who's, like, you know, sitting in remand or is in jail or is in prison or is facing some very serious charges. It's a it's a very personalized relationship you have with your council, and getting to know them outside of work a little bit. You know, many lawyers will want to put up some guards in terms of mixing personal and professional lives, but understanding, you know, what their interests are, what do they do? How are you giving back? What service work do you do? How do you like helping people? Is it all about you? Is it, do you have a massive ego, or are you humble enough that you want to serve your community, be involved, help out? I think that makes well-rounded people. And I think that when I think of the most successful lawyers that I know, they're very charitable people. They're very charitable people in their communities. They give back. They're very giving with their time, helping younger lawyers, helping just people generally want to help people. And I think that that is very consistent with at least my network of friends who are at counsel. They genuinely want to help people. In terms of how, you can never really know. I mean, reputations certainly matter. Does hiring the person who has the most Google reviews and is the most expensive necessarily mean the best? No, it doesn't. But it could also, they could be very well talented. It can be kind of difficult, but you gotta trust your sense of judgment with who you're hiring. And you certainly want someone that's willing to believe in your case and willing to fight for you. I can think of an instance of a case that I did where this lady, this is a decided case. It was at the Alberta Court of Appeal where I was successful, where she pretty much had no one. And she'd been charged with aggravated assault, and she'd stabbed a guy, pretty much gutted up his stomach, stabbed him pretty substantially, gave pretty inconsistent testimony at trial about that, but she was actually being sexually assaulted at the time. And there was a sexual assault kit that didn't make its way into evidence, which was kind of shocking how her first lawyer wouldn't have had that. So I was able to chase that kind of down in my own work, go and actually hunt down that sexual assault kit. And I won the Alberta Court of Appeal on a unanimous decision. It's far and effort, I think 2021 ABCA 388. And then when it went to a retrial, it got dismissed. So, you know, and that took one person believing in her, right? And that, to your point, all that took one person, I believe, and a lot of that I didn't really even get paid a lot for doing that work. And it wasn't why I did it. And it was certainly early on in my career. And I'm not saying everybody's still going to go to that length to do that for people, but, you know, having someone that really believes in your cause, or if there's an injustice, that genuinely believes in it. And again, it comes back to people can sense sincerity. People know when you're sincere. I really believe that, that people know when you are being sincere about wanting to help out. And, what I would look for is someone that's really committed, to service, committed to justice, committed to, upholding people's rights. That's a tough thing to do, right? You know, when you're doing human rights work and this type of work, it's not always easy. It's certainly not always easy. It's certainly not always popular, and people, and you know, not everyone can understand the length and effort that it goes through to do that. What people you agree with, disagree with, upholding human rights and upholding charter rights is a very difficult thing, and it takes a committed council to do that and be willing to go the distance for you. And you know, how can you definitively know based on a 30-minute call with someone? No, you can't. There's no way you would be able to, but you know, I would recommend do your research, talk to them on a human level, get to know them a little bit, what they're about, ask around your network of friends in your community, and make the best judgment you can.
That's a great answer. I like that a lot. Mm-hmm. So Blair, we have a question here from one of our longtime viewers, Ashley. Ashley's wondering, does Blair see a difference between being an advocate and being an activist, not just in relation to his case, but now we see BLM-minded lawyers. So do you see a difference between advocacy and activists, and what do you think about activist lawyers?
I'm not going to comment on activist lawyers, but I do believe there's absolutely a difference between an advocate and being an activist. Those are two completely different things. Being an advocate requires a level of neutrality in terms of how you're assessing a case. You don't want to go in with an answer with a view already made up in your mind. Can people have interests outside? Of course, everybody has their own causes they want to fight for and push for. But in terms of that, I mean, advocacy comes first, right? That is the each set of facts is different. Each case is different. It has its own unique perspectives that you need to bring to it. Can you have, you know, activist interests outside? Sure. And I'm sure people do. But I would say there's a difference. With respect to BLM lawyers, I'm not going to comment on that. I don't know.
I think his point was, is there a difference? I think this was...
Oh, absolutely. No, there absolutely is a difference. There absolutely is a difference. And being a fierce advocate is distinguishable from being an advocate or being an activist for something. Is definitely different. And it requires a different level of analysis with things. Like, because when you're being an advocate, you also have to put yourself in the shoes of the opposing party. And you have to understand their arguments, understand their positions very, very well. And that comes back to stress testing a case. Like, before I have you know, take on stuff and do things. I look at from all angles, from all perspectives, do the evidence quadratics and analyze things from different perspectives. And I think that, not to say people can't wear two hats or hold two thoughts in their mind at the same time, but if you're just viewing it purely from an activist perspective, there's things you could miss. There's absolutely things you could miss. Why you want to have good advocates, again, is that you can bring a level of neutrality to it. You can anticipate what the other side's going to do. And I always like to say, we're playing chess, not checkers here. What I'm doing now on is sets moves up down the road. When I'm asking on a cross-examination, those opening questions, that's setting something up down the road that I'm going to do when I'm making closing arguments. It's not random. It's not by accident. And I think that, you know, when you look at the talented lawyers, I think when I'm observing the talented lawyers, that's what they do. They view their case in a very neutral perspective. They advocate when it's their time to do your oral submissions and oral arguments, but the lead up to that, you're constantly stress testing your case. You're constantly trying to find weaknesses in your case. And you have the humility to take your ideas to your colleagues and say, hey, shred this, rip this apart. How would you come at me? And have, you know, not be so embedded to an answer or where you want to go based on who says it. And again, having not a huge ego with things. And I think that goes a long ways. And I think it shows. And I think of, when I think of the exceptional and talented people, I think that's what they bring.
So would you say an advocate fights for the client, whereas an activist fights for a cause? And that's kind of the difference between the two?
That'd be fair. That would be a fair assessment, because when you're doing a trial or a case, you're not doing it for a cause. You're doing it for the individual client, right? That's all that matters. That is all that matters is the individual client's interest in the case in front of you. That's it. That's, we are all duty bound to our clients. And you know, it takes a tremendous sacrifice. Like, I mean, I work with young kids. Often I have to go to Ottawa routinely. I don't know how that, Ottawa seems to keep calling me back. Just a good Alberta boy coming down there to kind of tell them how it is, I guess. I don't know, but I have to, you know, make sacrifices. And last time I did miss coaching a weekend of hockey, which I'm very dedicated to coaching hockey. Really love coaching the little guys and really seeing how their growth and development happens. So it's, kind of went off a little bit. But in terms of the difference between an advocate and an activist, exactly. It's always client-driven, individual case-by-case basis, not arguing for a cause writ large. Maybe there are elements from a particular case that can impact something writ large, but it's purely the individual client's case that matters. That's it.
I love that answer. I love that answer a lot, because that's my thinking of it as well. As an advocate, you're fighting for someone. As an activist, you're fighting for something. And those are two very different things. And if you're, in my mind, I don't know about yours, but in my mind, if you are in the court as an activist, you've got the wrong role. That's my opinion. That's for policy. That's for somewhere else, not for court. Do you think, and I'll go to Donald in a second here, Blair, do you think, give me your opinion about judicial notice. We had a good conversation yesterday about it when we were doing our NCI report. Judicial notice on, for example, COVID and the vaccines, it seems to be pretty set right now. The judges are taking safe and effective as judicial notice, for example. How do you feel about judicial notice in general? And is there room for some reform around it? Because it seems like even if it's disputed, it's still being used. What's your opinion on judicial notice?
Yeah, so judicial notice, as I understand it, is where a judge can basically take notice of something that is so widely accepted as fact, right, that you don't need to adduce evidence and proof of it at a trial. That's something I think that should be rarely used, and it should be for obvious things, right? A judge could take judicial notice that there is a war in Ukraine happening right now. A judge could take judicial notice of things that are just very obvious with that. So I don't know what your, I didn't watch your NCI with specific reference to it. I think judicial notice can be effective, but I mean, where it can, and it can be effective for the most obvious things, right? Like this, you can take judicial notice that the sky is blue and I guess white with clouds, right? I mean, things are just plainly, patently obvious. Where I think that it could be, and I'm speaking in generalities, I don't know what specifically you're referring to, but if you're taking judicial notice of things that are contested or are not established as fact, as being an objective fact, like or capital T truth, something that's being objectively just true by definition, something that's demonstrably just true. Like it is the truth that it is December 1st today. That is just an objective. Mm-hmm. You take judicial notice of that. It's not contested. Anyone that would suggest otherwise, you know, given again, you think Alberta time, then that would be an instance where that's an obvious judicial notice thing. When it gets into things that I think are contested, and again, I haven't seen this personally in my experience where a judicial notice has been leaned on or relied upon for something that is heavily contested. So I generally, in general terms, don't have a problem with judicial notice, but again, it would be context specific to what you're referring to.
Sure. There's a few judgments out there and there's a few matters out there related to COVID or vaccine and stuff like that. And judicial notice is being taken on the safe and effectiveness of it. And it's not being allowed to be challenged whether or not it was safe and effective. We can get you some of this matter, some of the matters behind the scenes. So maybe you can comment behind the scenes. But I just wanted to, in general, in my mind, judicial notice should be undisputed fact. As simple as that. Undisputed fact. And the moment it's disputed, it's no longer applicable as judicial notice. It should then be disputed and argued. But we're not seeing that all the time. One example would be Peckford. So Brian Peckford and the Ingram decision, he wanted to explain to the court how Section 1 is supposed to work and how demonstrably justified is supposed to be interpreted. Yeah. But the judge had judicial notice on how the charter works, Oaks test, et cetera, like that, and dismissed him. So he wasn't even able to argue that. Now, I may have some of this a little bit mixed up, whether or not judicial notice was applicable or not, but the judge certainly made a decision that Peckford, who helped write the charter, didn't understand the charter enough to become an expert witness in the matter. It's the things like that that bother me, because why is the judge the supreme decider on knowledge? I understand on law, I get that, but on knowledge, I think the judge has to be very careful about being the decider of knowledge, because that's what the court is for, is to determine whether or not something's true or not. So that's where I'm kind of pushing on that, because we're seeing this happen specifically around COVID and the vaccine, where judges are making decisions of knowledge based on stuff outside of the court and not allowing the arguments inside of the court. We can certainly get into that a little bit later, but you have any comments on that?
I don't know the particulars of the case. In my experiences, I have a lot of respect for judges and justices. They are excellent, and I tend to win a lot, so I definitely do not want to anger the judiciary in any way. Or take any shots at any judges. I mean, I have a lot of respect for judges, and that's a sincere, genuine. I have friends that have been on the bench, and they're all outstanding here. And so, you know, in terms of just judicial notice, or are you talking about, like, understanding the Oaks test in Section 1? I think that they're very well-versed in that. They would know the freedoms that are set out with respect to, you know, subject to only reasonable limits prescribed by law. I think they can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. It's something along those lines. They're very familiar with charter jurisprudence, right? They're extremely familiar with that. And especially at, you know, the Court of Justice level. I'm not sure what level Mr. Peckford's case was at, but, you know, you presume that the judges know the charter very well. And they, and in my experience, they do. They do. Like, and in terms of taking shots at the judiciary for what they're doing, I don't know that specific case, and that's not my experience. I have a lot of respect for the judiciary. Again, I tend to win the overwhelming majority of my cases, and I say that in a very humble, modest way, just factually speaking. So I'm absolutely not going to take any shots at any judges at all.
No, not needed either.
I very much admire what they do.
Yeah, no, I might be standing in front of one of them one day, so I want to be very careful about respecting the profession and respecting their roles, for sure. Now, Donald, I kind of want to get into grand juries now. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to you quickly and talk about briefly about the Coots situation and how you did a report on the evidence and you looked at the warrant and some of that stuff. And in your opinion, would a grand jury have allowed it to go that far based on the evidence you saw? And then I'm going to bring this back to Blair to ask him whether or not we need more grand juries and should we be using this more so that people like the Coots men may have a little bit of justice before they hit remand on the evidence side of things and whether or not there's enough evidence to support the charge to move forward.
Well, Blair, in the old days, and I had some old partners of mine who were police officers when we had a grand jury system in Ontario. And what that allowed was instead of the police charging people for some major charges, or they would charge them, but instead of going right to court, they would take it before a grand jury. And the grand jury would vet whether there was enough evidence. And sometimes it turned out that maybe people were charged for political reasons, and the the members of the community who were on the grand jury, they knew that, or there just wasn't enough evidence to satisfy them. And that would take care of the charges before it went further, and all the cost and expense and of jury trials and such. I don't know if you've been to my website, donaldbest.ca, but I did a report there back in June of 2023 about four Coutts accused. And these are the four men who have now been in remand for over 600 and some odd days. They were charged, they were denied bail, and it looks like they're not going to get to trial until well over 2 years has passed. So I did an analysis of the evidence, and you may or may not agree with it, but my conclusion was that the press conference, which included a photo of firearms on a table, that violated all the rules about forensic collection of evidence. There would have been DNA contamination between each of the exhibits. None of the exhibits were bagged. It was just absolutely pathetic. This photograph was used to declare on February 14th to declare the Emergencies Act. It was used as one of the pieces of evidence to substantiate it. My point is that the investigation, the presentation and collection of the evidence, the press conference, and the denial of bail was all political in favor of a political agenda. Now, you may not agree with that, but it's my point that if we had a grand jury system, I do not believe that these men would be rotting in jail right now. I just can't see that they're going to have enough evidence on the major charge, which is conspiracy to murder police officers in furtherance of the having a coup in over our government. That's basically what the charge is, and it's just, there's just no way they're going to be able to prove that. But still, these men rot in jail. I say a grand jury system might have been effective there at preventing what I believe is the politicalization of the whole process and the courts. So what do you think? Would you like to see grand juries return in a big way?
I've never experienced with grand juries. I think they were abolished in the 1970s. And we don't have grand juries in Canada. I think we did at one point. I'm working from memory. I think we did at one point. But we don't have grand juries anymore. We do have preliminary inquiries to weigh out the evidence. That's a big commitment, though, to have a grand jury, when you think about it, for jury duty for citizens and what that would rule. I mean, I'm in favor for more people actively knowing what's going on in the legal system. So I'm not, in theory, opposed to grand juries. I think that they're interesting tools that's more Americanized. That's a much more of an American tool that's used. I think there's some levels of secrecy that goes on in grand juries. I think that there's prohibitions on what gets released out of a grand jury. Again, this is a question off the cuff. I'm not in theory opposed to it, though. I'm not in theory opposed to it because, you know, and then the Coutts case is complicated, right? There's a number of complicated factors with the Coutts case that's active and ongoing that I'm not apprised of all the disclosure or any of that. That's difficult for me to comment on. In terms of what you're saying about the RCMP photograph, was evidence bagged properly? Was it not? Is there a chain of custody issue? Is there forensic issues? I mean, that's something for the Coutts lawyers, I'm sure that they'll pick up on. I know a couple of them. They're very, very competent, excellent lawyers. Toni Rolston in particular, I have a deep admiration for her. I think she is just outstanding lawyer. I would say probably the best criminal defense lawyer in Calgary. I have a tremendous, tremendous amount of respect for her and her legal skills and abilities. So I don't know the particulars of the case or those details, but I'm sure that they're, you know, and it can be, I do know enough of the case in terms of just what's publicly been available. That there's been a number of disclosure things ongoing, and that's the disclosures are important issues to continue to push on and fight for. You know, I do know these men have been held in remand without bail for going on 700 days. That's a lot. That's got to be difficult for them. You know, I visited clients in remand centers. That's not an easy place to be. Remand is not a fun place for someone to be. right? Like, I mean, people can be double, triple bonked. There's a lot of violence ongoing. It's a very, very difficult place to be in a remand center. That's not something that's, that I wish on people. And again, I don't know all the particulars of your deep dive on the evidence or if it's a purely political move. I can't comment on that. I can't comment on that. I don't know enough of the details about that. But, I do hope for the best. And I hope that truth prevails, whichever way that goes, and that the justice system works out the way it should in the end. So when that trial is, I'm not sure. I don't know the dates of the trials. I've got a pretty busy practice of my own. I do peripherally follow it where I can. And I do appreciate that you guys do spend a lot of time on it and are deeply involved in it. And I think that shining a light on active court cases the way you guys do, I think it's important to do. That's really what I know about the Coots case. I can't really get into too much further without,
I don't know
what the disclosure says. So it's hard for me to opine on something where I haven't seen the evidence.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is Donald did his best with the public information available to him, but there's also a lot of publication bans. So some of the information we can't get, some of the disclosure we don't know. We don't know the contents of the ITOs because there's bans on them. This whole envelope thing, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but that has a pub ban on it as well. So my next dovetail here is when there's publication bans and the court itself is withholding information from the public, two things happen. One, we're not educated on what's really going on. So we'll be out there speculating and coming up with our own version of stuff. And two, it also makes us suspicious about the system. Are they trying to hide something? I want to dispel both of those concerns because I don't believe the system's trying to hide things. It's just the way it is. But what is your opinion on publication bans and then the consequence of them, but the public really not knowing what's going on and nothing but fake information or fake news is flowing out there and not the truth? Because if the truth comes out, that's a violation of the pub ban. So it's really difficult in the public's space to actually know what's true, what's speculation, what is the real evidence. So when someone like Donald is looking at the public information to do his report, it may not be complete because there's a lot of disclosure not available and stuff under a ban. So generally, not on the Coots specifically, but generally, how do you feel about publication bans being put in place and the public kind of being left in the dark on some of these details?
Yeah, no, this is absolutely something I can jump into and get to because I've dealt with, again, I've done a number of drug trafficking, organized crime cases. There are very valid reasons to have publication bans. There absolutely are. I can think of instances where you're dealing with sexual assaults of a minor. That witness's name should absolutely be sealed. Witnesses who are minors 100% should always be sealed. So one of the things that comes up, and again, I'm not speaking to this particular Coots case. I don't know if there were undercovers involved, but typically when you have an ITO, and I think Donald would know this for his years of undercover work, the officer has to identify themselves who's doing this undercover work, right? And so defense lawyers can come into contact with those names and details about police officers involved, about confidential informants, CIs that are involved. And you can actually get instances as a defense lawyer where you're getting this information. You can't even tell your client about it, about that, who it is, who the identities are, because when you're dealing with criminal organizations, that could, leaking that information could get people killed. Like, and that's right. That's not without an exaggeration. That can actually happen. And so to save a future life, to save a future principles apply. So when you're dealing with federal prosecutors, in my experience, at least, they're outstanding counsel. There are very valid reasons for having publication bans. One I can think of is officer and officer protection, working with like defense lawyers. Like, we have to work with police officers and Crowns. They are our colleagues, right? And there are a number of instances where you have to protect that police officer's identity who were involved as undercovers. And that is something that I've always upheld and take that very, very seriously. And that is something I've always honored in dealing with trafficking or organized crime related cases. And I voluntarily agree with the prosecutors when they ask for publication bans in those circumstances. So, again, I don't know what's going on with the Coots case. I'm just speaking, again, generally.
In
my experience with that. If there was an ITO, I don't know, which is an information to obtain, which is similar to basically the warrant that they use to justify any actions that they take with that. So I understand that there could be, the public may have issues with some secrecy in that regard, respecting, why we subject to publication bans. There are generally, I would say, very good reasons for why that is in place, and that is to protect officers, their families, confidential informants. There could be larger criminal investigations that are ongoing that defense lawyers cannot just actively interfere with by revealing names or any of that. So you know, it's one of the things being a defense lawyer, where you are a very trusted broker. You are a very trusted part of the integral part of the system. And you can advocate for your clients while having publication bans and knowing that information. You can still advocate for it. You know, there are proceedings to deal with things so it doesn't go out into public information that gets used. And I think it's an important part of it. I really do. And it may not always be understood why or the reasons for it. That's just my view on it with my experience and speaking in generalities, not anything in particular with the Coots case, because again, I can't speak to the of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I respect that a lot there, Blair, that we can't get into the details because you don't know it, and that's fine too. And also to protect the jury so that the jury is not filled with false information or information they shouldn't have ahead of time is another one of the reasons why I actually do support pub bans on certain things. I only have a couple more questions. I know we're already at time. Can we steal a few more minutes of your time?
You can take a few minutes. I do have a meeting. I was going to go.
Yeah.
It's a hybrid one, so I can do it by Zoom. It does start at 7:30. If we push on, we're having a good conversation. I definitely really enjoy talking with you guys, so we can do a little bit more.
Yeah, sorry about that. And I will definitely have you back when Bathsheba's back, and we can do it again. I only have two more questions, and then maybe Dawn. Mootness. So we saw a couple cases dismissed on a federal level, Brian Peckford, for mootness. Now, how do you feel about mootness? Because as a criminal defense attorney, your defendant or client are moot. They're not committing a crime anymore. So why can't you use the mootness argument that the federal government's been successful with getting the claims thrown out on?
That's a little bit different. That you know, a client who's been you know, alleged to have committed a criminal act, it's not really mootness. Mootness is more where the proceedings are kind of are out of reach and they can't make a ruling on it. So it's one of the arguments that was made in the Federal Court Act, where we challenged the usage of the Emergencies Act to freeze bank accounts and the Emergencies Act in place. One of the arguments that the Crown presented was that it's moot because the Emergencies Act isn't in place right now, right? That's more where mootness goes, where what you're seeking, it's not enforced in effect at the time when you're before the courts. You know, the argument against that is, well, how could we possibly get this before a court and before a review before it expired, before it was moved?
Right.
Courts don't move that fast, right? So every time it's invoked, it would be moved. So one of the decisions on mootness that came out, especially in Alberta, had dealt with under the Mental Health Act, where they would detain people under mental health reasons, and they would go and argue for a judicial review. They'd be released by that time. So the argument is, well, it's moot. They're already released. They're not being currently held. And the Alberta courts have said, there's a number of decisions that came out where they didn't accept that argument. They said, no, well, then there would never be an ability for someone to challenge that if this was the case. So mootness does get relied on a lot in judicial reviews, a lot, especially when legislation expires or, you know, the person is not affected by the impugned provisions at that time. That's where the government argues on mootness, whereas, you know, for a defendant to say, well, you know, the alleged criminal act happened before, so therefore it's moot, that wouldn't really fly on the legal principles.
No, fair enough. And I hope the government, and it looks like it might be this way, they'll go do an action knowing that it will be moot by the time it reaches a judge. I hope that's not a pattern that we continue to see, and that's what I kind of highlight there. Because I think once the claim is filed, once the case is before the judge, they should finish it. Because example for the mootness ones on the federal level, they might just do it again. So we need to have the precedent set. Like, what is the decision? So I push back a bit on the federal stuff when it comes to moot, because it seems like it's a bit of a cop-out because the process takes so much time, they can get away with it. But I think this could be an entire episode on moot and the federal cases, and I do want to get you to your appointment. So I'll move on to the next question. This comes from one of our viewers. $200,000 as a retainer for Chris L's retainer sounds excessive. Now, I'm not asking you to justify or condemn the amount. That's not the question here. The question here is to let people understand $200,000 for a criminal defense for a matter like the Coots situation, that's not a lot of money from my perspective. What do you think?
Again, not knowing the particulars, but assuming this goes to a 1 or 2 week trial with the number of interlocutory applications and the amount of work, that doesn't, again, I don't know the particulars. I don't want to comment on that.
Yeah,
that can seem out of line. You know, like, and I don't, again, like I I hope that people can understand the amount of work that actually goes in into mounting a formidable defense. Like, it is time away from families. It is long, 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 long hours in boardrooms, in things that are not, you don't see the amount of effort and work that goes into that. Again, I'm not going to comment on the particulars of a retainer that I'm not a party to, or what the disclosure obligations are, or what financial stuff is there. But for, you know, a couple week trial, I don't know. Yeah, that doesn't seem out of line. Yeah, that doesn't seem out of line from my perspective, again, without knowing the facts and the particulars that are leading to this retainer agreement with them. And again, I'm not going to call it another lawyer's retainer. I can just say that, you know, if it's a multi-week trial, it doesn't seem out of line at all for me.
That's what I was getting at. For this particular type of thing, a criminal, they're in remand, it's conspiracy, there's a lot of moving parts, lots of disclosure, a lot of pretrial. It's not a lot of money, $200K. To us, it seems like a lot, because that's like 3 or 4 years worth of salary for people like us. But when it comes to the work that needs to be done, it's expensive.
I get that. And look, I came from pretty humble beginnings. I certainly wasn't handed. I'm not in a corner office now because this stuff was handed to me. So I get that. I didn't grow up with a lot. Points in my life before I was a lawyer, when I was playing football in British Columbia, where I had next to nothing when I met my wife, $7 in my bank account at one point, when I was, and she helped me get back to school. So I can certainly understand that. I never have lost sight of where I came from and to be here now. So I do appreciate that. That does may seem like a lot of money, but it is a lot of work. There are a lot of resources that get used and put into this. And again, a lot of time, effort that people do. I hope that I helped, we didn't get too into the legalese for your audience here. And I do hope that this was a good show.
Yeah, you're awesome.
I wanted to make some time out to, I know you've been asking me to come on, and Bathsheba as well. I wish Bathsheba could be here. She obviously had flight issues, so. It is what it is, but I'm very, very thankful to be on here, and I hope that a message taken away is that there are a lot of good lawyers out there. And the justice is not this completely, totally, and utterly corrupt place. I don't think that is true. I don't. I just don't. I wouldn't be doing this if I did. I wouldn't. And oftentimes, and I think this would be a good leaving note. Oftentimes, people want to look at problems as being systemic. Systemic issues, systemic, everything is a system against us. But oftentimes in history, they've shown us repeatedly that it's one person, it's a handful of people that take a stand for something, that stand up to something, that make a big difference, right? That buck the system, that stand up and put their feet down. Maybe it's, I can just hear I lost my grandmother about a year ago coming up. She's a very proud Scottish woman, and how Scottish people are wired. And I definitely got that wiring, I think, from her to stand up to tyranny, to fight. And that's something that I'm going to continue to do and adopt. And I think that there are a number of good lawyers that are doing this right now and trying it and doing what we can. And I hope it does make a difference, a cumulative difference in the end, because history will be written about this at some point in the future. And we'll look back at this. And I think that there's a number of good things that are happening and that people aren't just capitulating and rolling over. And certainly at my firm, we will adopt excellence is the only standard, and we're going to fight for our clients. We will hold governments accountable. We will be fearless advocates. It is terrifying to fight face down the state for the people that are accused criminally. And then also, it takes guts and stones to do this as lawyers, right? Like, we're taking on some serious, taking on entire justice departments, right? Whereas, outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, and we're fighting. And we are going to continue to do that and continue to be fearless advocates. That's how I'm going to choose to live my life and have, hopefully... Hopefully it continues. I like what we're doing, and I think it's important what we're doing. And I think I'm going to keep faith and hope that God continues to give me opportunities to use my skills to serve. And that's the motto I'm going to take. And I think that it's in the long run, it's going to work out. I really do. I really do have that hope and faith and optimism about it. It's not always easy. It is definitely not always easy when you're in the thick of things trying to deal with this stuff. If I didn't believe in this and I didn't believe that truth and justice would prevail in the end, I wouldn't be doing this and I wouldn't make these sacrifices in my life and do it. So yeah. Hopefully it all works out. I definitely believe it will.
Excellent answer. And excellence is the only standard. I love that. Should be on a T-shirt. We should have that everywhere. Donald, do you have a last comment? Because he has a meeting to run to.
Just wonderful. Thanks so much. And we'd love to have you back with Bathsheba. To talk about more about all these things. I one of the things that people don't understand is why it's so expensive. And I think that we could address that in more detail, and then people will understand why it's so important for us to help the decent Canadians who just stood up for all of us. And now, in order to hire top drawer lawyers, they need the funds, and we have to help.
Excellent comment there, Donald. And that's exactly what we're trying to do here, Blair, is put the faith back into the system, the justice system, the fundraising system, and just Canada in general. So thank you very much for your time today. Go hit that meeting. Have yourself a great day. And one day, hopefully, you'll come up here and shoot some ducks with me.
I will do. I do bring some shotguns up. So I appreciate the show, guys. God bless. And thank you for the attention that you guys are putting on this. I know you guys have pride to get information from me about the case. I stonewalled every single time, and I won't continue to do that when it comes to active cases. But in terms of talking about general legal principles, put it through Scottish Lad, he's always ready for a vowel. I can just hear my grandma's voice saying.
Well, look what Brother T is saying. Blair, Braveheart, Hector. Proud, feisty, and never give up Scotsman. There you go. You got your own slogan now. Braveheart.
Definitely can thank my grandma for that. She was a tough battle axe and instilled that toughness and resiliency in me from a young age. And so I do want to again thank you guys and thank your audience for this. It was an honor to come on and keep bringing a light to this.
Thank you.
It's our wins in the end.
Absolutely. God bless you. Right will prevail in the end. Take care, Blair. Have a great meeting, and we'll talk soon, brother.